And we're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 18th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Beverly Donofrio. Beverly has published a few children's books and three memoirs. Her first, the cult classic, Riding in Cars with Boys, was made into a popular movie starring Drew Barrymore. Her latest is Astonished, a story of evil, blessings, grace, and solace, published by Viking. So glad to have you on, Beverly. Are you there?
Yes, I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, dear. Anyway, sometimes it happens, and, you know, you're here with us. So I'm so happy to have you, and I'm just starting to record the show so we can podcast it. There we go. We're on with Beverly Donofrio, and if we could begin by talking about Astonished, and if you would talk about how the book came about, that would be a pleasure.
Well, 7 years ago, in the middle of the night, in the middle of middle age, I was raped in my bed in Mexico by a serial rapist. And it had just so happened that at that time in my life, I had begun looking for monasteries to join. And when this horrible thing visited my life, my first reaction, almost more than, oh no, now I'm going to be raped, was, God, how could this happen now? When I pray to you every day, when I contemplate you, when I'm trying to figure out a life so that I can be close to you. And so that event launched a journey. I ended up going to monasteries, and now with a much more heated agenda, I needed to heal, and I really needed to examine how a God I conceived and believe is a loving God created a world where these sorts of things can happen, where there is evil and suffering. And it's an age-old question, and I don't know that I came up with any new answers, but I did come up with some piece about it and healing.
Yes, yes. Well, I love the book, and I love your writing, and
Thank you.
I'm curious if then did the event precipitate the book, or were you working on, you know, it's time to write another memoir, am I going to write about?
No, actually, when this happened and I went off to monasteries, I made a decision early on that I wasn't going to document my experience. I wasn't going to report on what was going on. It's kind of like when you go somewhere with a camera and you're not really in the moment because you're outside of it looking at it. I did not want that to happen. The most important thing to me, more than my writing, more than my lifelong, actually, vocation, was this new thing, this getting close to God, this opportunity, as I saw it, to, I don't know, how could I say it, to become different, to shed my ego, to wear a real face, to use this pain to become more pure. So I didn't write about it, but I'm a writer, so, you know, at the time I was finishing a children's book, and I would write on that, and I kept a journal kind of just sporadically, like, you know, walking in the Arizona desert at one of the monasteries, hearing a flute issuing from a cave, and, you know, I'd kind of like just write little moments like that. And then some almost 4 years later, three and a half, it became different. It just was time to write about it. And early on, though, I wrote an article for the newspaper right after it had happened to me, because I realized it was a serial rapist. The only things that had been published before were the facts about the attacks, like it happened at this time, at this evening, to this woman at this address. And I had some information about this rapist because I'd talked to one of the investigators and I knew some of the other victims, which had helped me get through the ordeal kind of in a, I don't know, I can't say unharmed way, but a less horrible way than it might have been had I known nothing. So I wrote the article for the paper, and in doing that, knew what I always knew, that there's power in words, and that writers have an obligation. And so not too long after that, I did write kind of a, undigested, raw reporting of the incident that I published in O Magazine because I was adamant to share what I had found out, which was you have to talk about it. We cannot, I don't think it's behooves we women to be silent when something like this has happened to us, that we did nothing to be ashamed of, the rapist did, and we should not hide in shame. And so, and I still believe that, and that was an impetus for writing the book, and it was an impetus for that O Magazine article.
Well, it's interesting because the voice of the book is sort of counterpoint to the experience of rape, and which is something I found really interesting and effective because, you know, it was a story, you know, I don't know, I wanted to stay with it. I wanted to stay with you. It was more than about what happened. It was, you know, there's so many layers to the book. Maybe at this point it would be wonderful to hear you read so that our listeners could understand what I'm talking about in terms of voice.
Well, I probably chose the wrong reading for this. because, I mean, I just really believe the only way you can write about pain is humorously. And the only way you can go through life is looking for the humor in it and the joy. And hopefully there's that in this book. But this little excerpt isn't that.
Well, that's okay. Just read it.
Okay. All right. So I need to set it up a little bit.
Okay.
When I went off to the monasteries, I would... And actually, for 3.5 years afterwards, I would awake in the night, maybe 2 times a week, convinced that there was an evil presence in my room, even when I was awake. And so this has just happened. I'm at the second monastery I've gone to, and this is what I write about it. At night, as I lie in bed, awake, terror-struck, it's not exactly the physical act of rape I think of or react to so much as everything that attended it. Being under another's control, the binding of my will, the threat of more violence and humiliation, the tang of evil stinking the air like a dead skunk. I think it all adds up to this. What I'm dreading is my own fear. I think how in the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ knew that all of those horrors I just mentioned were going to happen to him the next day, with the possible exception of evil stinking the air like a dead skunk, but maybe it did. When Christ was tempted in the desert by Satan, resisting all the wily one's temptations, it says in Luke, and Satan left for a time. Maybe Satan returned and was in the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm not sure I even believe in Satan, but I believe in evil, and I believe fear bows at the feet of evil, and I believe that the dark presence that wakes me and lingers in my room, the presence that causes me so much fear, is evil. I do not hold on to this because I'd rather not believe this. It's too scary. I suspect that, like the history teacher in my high school, a World War II vet who dived under a desk when he heard a loud noise thinking it was a bomb, I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. His trigger was a loud bang, but mine, because it happened when I was sleeping at night, is probably the dark and sleep. God, I pray all the time, heal me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Beverly Donofrio reading from Astonished. A Story of Evil, Blessings, Grace, and Solace, published by Viking. See, I heard a little humor in there, and I think it was the stinking the air like a dead skunk line, you know?
That Latin apparition in my room.
You know, I mean, that's what I mean. It wasn't, you know, a raucous, it's not a raucous book of, you know, how funny this was. But,
right.
You know, the humor just laces through the voice really nicely, and... And I'm guessing that's just how you are. I'm guessing that you are just sort of a, you know, someone that does try to see the humor. Like you said, you try to see the humor in things. And so it comes through in your voice, whether you mean for it to or not.
Yes, the worst I can do is try to be funny, then I never am.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case with everybody.
Oh, really? That comforts me.
No, my son is funny, and when he tries to be funny, I'm like, that wasn't funny. And
yeah, that's really lame, right?
Yeah. So you know, earlier, a few weeks ago, you told me via email that you have sold all of your books via proposal versus writing the entire memoir.
Yes, I've been very fortunate in that way. The first book, Writing Cards with Boys, I had written the first thing I published in the Village Voice, a personal essay, and I had been to graduate school. I got my MFA at Columbia, and my mentor there was Richard Price, and he read it, and he called up and said, call my agent, you could get a book with this. So I said, do I have to? And he said, I'll call her for you. And he did. God bless him. And the agent said, listen, pretend you have 5 minutes to tell a garden party why in the world they should be interested in your life. It took me 3 months to write the 5 pages, but I wrote the 5 pages and like a 1 or 2 line little encapsulation of how I envisioned every chapter to go, and we sold it for $10,000, and that was my first experience. And then I had Writing Cars with Boys, which sold to the movies and sold pretty well. At, you know, people bought the book, and I had a track record. And so the next time I wrote a proposal for my book, Looking for Mary, and that was 20 pages and a chapter breakdown. Then this last time, for Astonished, my agent says, Bev, it's a whole different ball game out there. You have to write, I want to see like maybe 100 pages of the text and a proposal and a chapter breakdown. So I wrote the chapter breakdown was so hard. It was 30 pages, but for the first time, I really did figure out the book before I wrote it. I saw the arc. I saw what was going to go in each chapter. So when I sat down to write, I had been writing all along, so the first couple of chapters were close. But from there on, it only took me a year to write, and I sold it with the first 3 chapters, which were like 60 pages, and the proposal and the chapter breakdown. And I find it's great getting an editor involved from the beginning, because then they're invested in you and in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. But what you say in terms of creating the chapter breakdown, I think that is probably a horror story for most
it is. It's
writers.
Hard.
But it's so helpful, hard. Right? I mean, it helped you see the book, like you said.
It did. But, you know, with the other two, I was very aware that they just want an idea of how you're envisioning this book. So when I wrote it, I didn't think I had to stick to it. And it was true this time, too, only this time I did it so thoroughly, I wanted to stick to it. So you could go either way. You could really, you know, take your time and really figure out your book to sell it, or you can just kind of have a more rough sketch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it might work better for some people with a rough sketch, because being tied down to, you know, something you figured out might not work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious about so many things, but one of them is tense, because writing in Cars with Boys, you wrote in the past tense, and Astonished is written in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, I wanted it to be immediate, and writing Cars with Boys was pretty much a straight chronological narrative,
mm-hmm.
where I knew with this one I was often going to be dipping into the past. So if it was easier, I don't know how to say it, formally to be in the present tense, and then when I'm talking about the past, be in the past tense.
Right. Yeah, I think it's totally effective. And voice is one of those things too that is really crucial, I think, in deciding how you're going to write your memoir. I mean, is it past tense? Is it present tense? Is it a little of both? And why? And have that be a conscious decision as opposed to just, well, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you can be in the past tense and slip into the present tense when you're going into a scene and you're recounting a scene and you want it to be really immediate, but you do have to be aware of what you're doing, and that then you leave that and go back to the past.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, okay, so you did this incredible chapter outline for Astonished, and you knew...
It's not an outline. I want to emphasize that. I couldn't possibly...
Okay, breakdown.
Outline.
No, chapter breakdown.
Like, you know, little essays for each chapter.
Like, how long were the little essays for each chapter?
Well, I don't know how many chapters are in this book.
Let's see.
It would vary according to the chapter. Let me look at how many chapters are in the book. I think they're like 12 chapters, and it was 30 pages. So what does that average out to? I don't know.
Okay. So like two and a half, three.
Yeah, but then there would be, you know, maybe one paragraph for one chapter, and then another would, I'd get into more detail because I felt like it. And that would be 10 pages. I mean, maybe not five pages.
So, okay, so then, and you saw where the arc of the story was, you saw how it ended. Were there any surprises along the way? Any discoveries that you didn't intend or that,
oh,
that
yeah,
this came
at you?
Oh,
yeah, a lot of the anecdotes and a lot of, you know, the color, kind of the details. I had no idea how I was going to color in those bones, put flesh on those bones, you know. And there were many things in this book that I had been wanting to write about for years and couldn't find a format for them that I was able to put in, which I really loved. Like, one was, I was in Mexico. I went bird watching for the first time in my life early one morning, and people all saw a bird in a cliff, on a cliff face, in a crevice at a cliff face, and I couldn't see it, and they show me it through the, what are they called? Binoculars, and finally I see it, and then I leave early because I'm exhausted with the whole thing, and on my way home, where I walk three times a week for years, I see high up on a tree, this huge white bird, like 2 feet tall, on the top of a dead branch, and I thought, how many times do I walk by things and not see them? And how did this, that the first one that I couldn't see, open my eyes to see this one? And what in my life am I not seeing, you know, in a more emotional way? And I was able to put that in the book, and then finally I was able to write what I wanted to write.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Beverly Donofrio. Her book is Astonished, A Story of Evil, Blessings, Grace, and Solace, published by Viking, and she's also author of Writing in Cars with Boys and Looking for Mary or The Blessed Mother and Me. Talk about that memoir, Looking for Mary. How did that come about?
Well, I began, well, I was 40 years old. I was depressed. I go to a therapist. She says, you need to start loving yourself. And I said, yeah, great. How do I do that? And she said, oh, you can find a man or someone who loves you and then unconditionally, and then you can love yourself. And I said, great. I've been looking for that all my life. And then said, well, sometimes people find the love of God will help them love themselves. And I had a fit. I was raised Catholic. I said, God made me believe if I stubbed my toe, I did something wrong. No, thank you. And so she said, well, meditate and just imagine some spirit. And so I did, and I felt better, and I go off. One day I'm feeling less depressed. I realize my house is empty. I'd be a lot less depressed if I bought some furniture. I go off to a yard sale and see this Virgin Mary in a framed postcard. And I snapped it up like I was a starving street dog that just been thrown a T-bone steak. And it became an obsession, my collecting Marys, with no idea what I was doing, just thought I was filling my house with this wonderful kitsch. And now I think I opened a door and Mary came in, and it was the beginning of a spiritual conversion in which I realized if I could possibly believe in her, who I think of as the feminine face of God, the uber mom, the mother goddess, I really maybe could heal. My life might change. I might feel less alone and less empty, but I didn't believe. So I went to Virgin Mary Apparition Site. I had this idea to go to Virgin Mary Apparition Site to do a documentary with my friend David Isay for NPR. And in the process, the people we spoke to would say, pray the rosary, it will change your life. Go to Mass every day, and you won't believe how different you feel. And so I thought, okay, for the purpose of this documentary, I'm going to try it. I'm going to act as though I believe, and maybe belief will follow. And to make a longer story shorter, that's what happened, and that's the story of that book.
Wow. Well, you know, I just I like these books so much, and I like that you're handling a sort of like a heroine's journey and a spiritual quest, and yet, you know, sometimes, you know, I think books that are spiritual or religious are just a bit too much to take, and
they take themselves too seriously.
Yeah. And yours don't at all, and that's just such the charm about them. So you're a memoirist. You've been a memoirist your son's entire life, and you write about him, and you write about others. You know, how do you handle the truth? How do you handle people close to you that you're writing about? Do you run things by them? Do you show them finished manuscripts before you send it to your agent?
Well, you know, I never did until this one. I just was totally insensitive. Really, to tell you the truth, I hardly considered anybody. I mean, I think I really am a born memoirist because, you know, I have students who will say, but they're blocked in writing because they're so fearful of the effect they're going to have on the people close to them. And I never even cared. It's really terrible. And then after Writing Cards with Voice came out, my father, he doesn't speak very much, but he did speak to my mother, and he said to my mother, I think she was trying to get back at me. And I was. I mean, I just recently read that book again. I can't believe what a nightmare daughter I was. What an attitude. Oh, my God. But anyway, so this I'm more mature now, and I have a track record of having published these books and seen that I do have an effect on the people who are in my books. So this time, I ran it by the principal people who are in it. And not my parents, though, but they don't read. They didn't read my books, so I didn't have to show it to them. And plus, they're so old.
Mm-hmm. So Jason, you ran it by him, and he's like,
oh. No, I didn't run it by Jason. He's hardly in this one.
Yeah. And when he is, it's nice.
I ran it by, like, the monks. I ran it by, you know, people I wrote about at the monasteries. I think that's maybe it. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm lying. Mm. I'm still doing the same stuff. I'm not really thinking about people.
Well, back to Writing Cards with Boys. Were you happy with how the movie came out?
I am. I have one. I mean, it's its own thing. It's fictionalized. It brought people to my book who never would have read my book had they not seen that movie, which is a wonderful thing. It had the same basic heart, I think, as my book. But one of the driving forces for my writing the book was to let kids know that when they screw up bad, like I did when I got pregnant in high school, that it is not the end of the world, even though it feels it at the time, that you can turn it around. And the best way, the shortest shortcut to that is get yourself to college. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, I don't get to go to college. It just broke my heart. Mm-hmm. So when I would tell the producer, James L. Brooks, over and over again, but she needs to go to college, he would say, but she published a book. Mm-hmm. To him, a huge success, Hollywood success, who never graduated college himself, he didn't even get it, you know? Mm-hmm. It was, the success was that, well, you published a book. But that wasn't the success. The success was, you know, getting an education and feeling different about myself because of it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about Revision? Revision is another horror story for a lot of writers who really try to get around it in lots of ways. And curious about yours. If you clean it up as you go along, or do you do draft after draft, or how does it work?
Both. Revision to me is writing. I mean, my first drafts, I couldn't possibly show them to anybody. And in memoir, I'm convinced that it takes, for me anyway, and for many people, I've seen it with my students too, it takes many drafts, many revisitings to kind of break through the resistance, to soften your heart, to get back to the real, the truth, and the pain, and because it's not accessible to you right off the bat. And what warms you up to it is revisiting and revisiting and revisiting, I think. So I rewrite as I go along. I finish a whole draft, and that's when it gets really fun, when you go back the next time and you see connections you didn't even know you had made, that you can then bring up and highlight. And but usually takes that first draft is pretty strong because I've been rewriting and rewriting all along the way.
Do you bring in readers at any point before you get it to your editor or agent?
Yes, I always give it to people before I... Well, I usually give it to people at the same time I give it to my agent, and then take their comments and rewrite it before I give it to my editor.
Mm-hmm. And dialogue. Talk about that, because I don't know if you keep journals, if you kept lots of journals along the way with all of your books, but... you know, dialogue is one more thing. Some memoirs say, I don't want to put it in quotes because I don't know if they really said it like that. And others go, well, that's what they would have said.
Yeah, well, memoir is memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're not going to remember every word. I mean, especially at my age, I can hardly remember what people said last night at dinner. So you just kind of have to reimagine the scene, put yourself there, say what you think you said, what you think everybody else said, and that's your memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 It's funny, though, how that can really kind of be problematic for writers.
Yeah, I think, you know, some people are really purists about it. I'm not.
Mm-hmm. The bright orange cover of Astonished, I happen to love, and I'm curious how that cover came about. I love all the little charms.
The embossed milagros,
mm-hmm.
those little charms.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Well, it was a senior, art designer who had just moved from another publishing house to this publishing house, and this was his first book, and he was a Mexican-American, and it really resonated with him, and he emailed me and told me, you know, how much, how powerful the book had been, and he asked me to choose the milagros that I would like on the cover, which ones meant something to me. He had gotten a whole bag of them. So I got to choose them, but they're changing it for the paperback. They can't emboss it on a paperback.
Yeah.
And I'm sure this was really expensive to produce, because it's got like yellow binding and yellow and orange in the threads. And oh, it's just a beautiful book.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
It feels really nice, too.
Yeah, and the paperback, they're changing the title a bit. It's going to be Astonished, A Story of Healing and Finding Grace, which is fine with me.
Yeah. How did you come up with the title to begin with Astonished?
Astonished, I had it in my notebook, and just the word, and one day I thought, well, that would be a good title, because basically it's what the book is about being shaken out of your life, and that's being astonished.
Hmm. And nowhere on the book is the word memoir. Maybe on the, you know, copyright page, but yeah. And that's kind of unusual, too.
Really? They always put memoir on the cover?
Well, you know, it seems like for a long, long time they were, and I need to look at some other more recent memoirs, but it's usually like, it would be like Astonished, Story of Evil, Blessings, Grace, and Solace, a memoir.
You know,
really?
I mean,
yeah.
Well, that would be redundant,
I think. Would be redundant.
They would have to say a memoir of evil, blessings, grace, and solace, which
right.
would be kind of lame.
Right. But, I mean, I like that it's a story, because that lightens the whole thing up a bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calling it a story instead of a memoir.
Yeah, and that's an important thing for people future memoirists, to realize that you are telling a story. It's almost like you're novelizing your life. You're putting meaning, and just like a novel. I mean, and it does have an arc, and not all of them do, but if you want it to be a page turner, that's what you're going to have to do.
And also, you know, what I'm finding in a rewrite of a memoir that I'm going through is that entire scenes, chapters, 10-page chapters that I thought were really important, now I can see might work well on their own or might work well in another book, but I'm reducing some chapters like that to a paragraph.
Oh, yeah, you have to be ruthless. You have to be able to read what you've written at a certain point. You have to be able to read what you've written as a reader and note when you're getting bored and note when your concentration is falling down. And yes, yeah, I have probably another 100 pages that aren't in this book. And in Writing Cards with Boys, I had written Writing Cards with Boys goes from being a teenage mother to going to college, and then it jumps to the end when I'm driving my son to college, and it summarizes in 20 pages our life from the time I graduated college, and he was 10, and to this time when he's 18 and he's going to college. So in between there, I wrote our whole New York life, 100 pages that I just excised. And actually it ended up, I mean, not those pages, but that period ended up in Looking for Mary, so it's never wasted.
Right. Yeah, and then what I'm finding, and it sounds like what you have found and what you know, is that those scenes, if it doesn't work for the story that you're telling, even if they're good scenes, it can't go in.
Right. You just put
that's
it in the
difficult.
You'll
that's
find
the
another
difficult
place,
thing.
Just like that bird on the tree.
Right. Right, right. So, you know, you're a memoirist, and your memoirs are written like novels. How did you go that way? How did you go down the lane of memoir instead of novel?
Well, when I began writing Cards with Boys, when I, you know, called that agent and had been writing and envisioning this book, I thought I was writing a novel. My agent sells it. I go off to meet my editor at a restaurant. He's James Landis, who he was the editor of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Oh, sure.
A very cool guy.
Oh, yeah.
And we meet, and I said, my novel. And he said, novel? I didn't buy a novel. I bought a memoir. And I said, oh, but I'm writing a novel. And he said, I can't sell a novel. I can sell a memoir about a teenage pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that moment, I thought, well, all right. And then realized I hadn't made a single thing up. And anyway, and then when we sold it to the movies, and for a short time, Jim and I were talking about the possibility of me writing the script. And he said, well, how would you write it? Tell me what this movie would be. And I couldn't make anything up for that either. So, you know, I bowed out. It was obvious that I wouldn't be able to do it. And I have a hard time fictionalizing my life. I think that the truth has power, and I always want to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, writing in Cars with Boys does read like a novel.
Mm-hmm. I meant fictionalizing my life.
Yes. All right. Which
yeah,
is wonderful.
Like a novel.
Yeah, which is wonderful that it's, you know, it's all what happened. And that, you know, I think there's such an art to writing memoir that that we can all take a lesson from writing Cards with Boys and Astonished. I mean, it's just they go on and you feel like you're in a fictional setting, but it's not.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So we are winding down to the end of our time. Curious if during the writing of Astonished or any of your books, if you found yourself in a place where it wasn't working and what you did to get out of it, or do you have a technique to just keep going no matter what?
No, the opposite of that. What I finally came to, Astonished was the easiest writing I've done. In the other two books, there came a time when I thought, I'm going to quit. I can't do this. I don't know how. And then went back and did it. But this time, I'd get to a point where it wasn't working, this chapter. I didn't even know what it was about. I didn't know how to proceed, whatever. And I would just let it go and maybe go on and work on the next chapter, or go off to the mall and go to Marshall's and buy a dress for $7, or, you know, and just kind of relax about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then when you come back, if you've let it go, you come back and you're fresh and relaxed and not freaking out, and you see, oh, this is what I was trying, what it's about, or, oh, well, if I began with the end instead of that beginning, then I could circle back, and that would be, you know, whatever. But if you just relax and just kind of have faith, and I prayed a lot. I prayed, like Emerson says, ask other authors, for dead authors, for help. And I asked poets and authors and saints, and I really wanted to believe that they could help, and so I believed that they helped, and it chilled me out.
That's really interesting. I have a friend that says she invokes dead authors, the muses, she gets writing, and it helps her. That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's more fun not to be doing it on your own. I love collaboration.
Oh, that's funny. So then also, when you were writing, are you writing telling the story to somebody? Or are you telling it to yourself? Who are you writing for, an audience? What, you know, who are you thinking of?
It's been different with the first book because I loved Jim so much, my editor. I wrote it for him. It was, you know, I'm going to entertain Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And this last one, I suppose Mary, too, I have kind of an audience. You know, I know that there are readers out there, and I'm writing for them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, I just wonder, you know, especially, you know, when you're writing a first book, I think, mm-hmm. you know, when you after your first book, I think it changes. But yeah, your first book, it's like, well, are you writing for your writer's group? Are you writing for, you know, imagined readers? Are you writing, you know, for your cat, your dog? I mean, who, you know, do you need an audience? I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. I think I did. And I had a great one because he had a good sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wanted to make them laugh.
Hmm. In closing, I wonder if you have any advice for the listeners, for the writers listening, if there's any advice that you received along the way that has stuck with you or has been helpful as you go
on. It's kind of hackneyed, but writing is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. You just have to put yourself in the seat.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to do it. And the more you do it, the easier it gets. It's kind of like exercising a muscle. You know, if you decide you're going to start running and you haven't run for a year, you start out really slowly and you build up your running chops. And if you continue running, it's easy and it's joyful, and it's the same with writing. You just have to do it.
Mm. That's true and so good to hear over and over again. And and it was good that we tried to reach each other over and over again because
I know, I can't believe it really worked.
It worked. You came on the show, and I've loved talking with you. And
and I appreciate it so much. Thank you. You're a wonderful interviewer. It was really fun, and I usually dread these things, which I did. But now it's over, and it's great. It happened.
And it will be podcast very soon. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Beverly Donofrio. Her books are Astonished, Writing in Cars with Boys, and Looking for Mary. And I don't know how. I discovered her through, I think I was Googling. I'm working on a proposal for a memoir, and I was working on the comparison sheet. And I think I Googled forgiveness or something. Up came her book. And I said, what's this? And then I found all her books, and I love it when that happens, when it happens like that. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. If you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com. We have Danny Shapiro coming in October. You can read about it and register if you like. And on September 26th, I believe it is, there is a free event taking place and I'm trying to find it from this email. Sonia Marsh is putting on an event for indie authors, and you could go to her website. It's soniamarsh.com, soniamarsh.com, and it's free, and the details are there. There's all kinds of door prizes, you know, free nights at resorts and restaurants and Laguna Playhouse tickets, all kinds of things. So lots of authors are going to be there, and it's an all-day thing. So check out Sonia's website, and Thank you for being with me. If you stuck it out at the beginning, sorry about that, but we made it work. And it's sort of like writing. If you stick it out, you're working on something, it's not working, you work it, you work it, you work it. Often, you can make it work. So tune in next week. Thank you so much for being here.